You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by the MLB.com Shop.
Hey everybody, welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking American League East with MLB.com's AL East beat reporters. We'll be talking new acquisition Everett Cabrera and the Orioles. We'll be talking new acquisition Yoan Moncada and the Red Sox. We'll be talking about the Yankee bullpen and their starting rotation, and of course a little A-Rod. We'll be talking about Grant Balfour looking to bounce back with the Rays, and we'll be talking about the closer situation and what to do with Yonder Navarro in Toronto. This is MLB.com Extras. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Talking Baltimore Orioles with MLB.com's Orioles beat reporter, Brittany Giroli. But the Orioles made kind of an unexpected move within the last few days, finalized it today as we speak, bringing in Everett Cabrera. They're set at second base. They're set at shortstop. How does Cabrera fit into this roster?
Well, what they could do, what they hope to do, is have another utility guy. He's going to get some looks at infield early on in spring, and then he's going to be in the outfield a little bit later on. They feel like with his defensive skills, having a guy who can back up shortstop J.J. Hardy, having a guy who can back up at second base, and prove that he's at least capable of playing some corner outfield could be a real weapon for them. I mean, this is a guy who stole 99 bases over the last three seasons, adds a different element to their roster. So I think he's challenging for that utility role. Ryan Flaherty is probably a guy who he's in direct competition with right now. They could do some interesting things if he can play outfield. Do they need David Lowe if he can play the corner outfield spot? So it presents a little bit of an unusual roster makeup, but keep in mind this team has done unusual things in the past, and they have Chris Davis suspended for opening day. So there's going to be a lot of changes in that first few days for the Orioles.
As much as they like scope, given that Cabrera has been a pretty capable defender at short, you think he might be a plus defender at second. Is there an opportunity for Cabrera to play himself into, if not a primary job at second, at least a decent number of innings at second based on his defense?
Oh, sure. But then the question is, how much do you want to limit Scope's, you know, improvement? Do you want to see what you have in Jonathan Scope? Do you want him to continue to get consistent at bats? Or do you want him to turn into a little bit more of a platoon situation? So I think there's a chance he can get more at-bats at second base and establish himself a little bit more, and that's going to depend on how he's doing, how Scope's doing, but certainly there is a chance for Cabrera to fit in that manner.
The other news today from camp was Chris Davis taking some time to chat with people. Where do you see him at, just sort of generally? I mean, he's an interesting case because he was having a really rough year even before his suspension last year. Seems like more than anybody, that's a guy who can really benefit just from turning the page and having a new season.
Yeah, I mean, he was really good when we spoke to him today, Matthew. Last month at FanFest, he wasn't quite as good, wasn't quite as open and honest a little bit about the things that are going on. That exemption now is not for Adderall. It's for a form of Adderall that he thinks will be able to help him a little bit better on the field and off the field. And he's a guy who pretty much admitted that having all that success in 2013, last year he was kind of left to wonder, should he do everything exactly the same? Should he change anything? And, you know, I think a lot of that mentally took a toll from having such a monster year in 2013. Then he got hurt early in 2014. He never really looked right at the plate. So this year it's almost better. Some guys thrive from being counted out. And Chris Davis, certainly, a lot of people are wondering, can he ever get back to where he was? So that could actually be better for him mentally. He seems to be in a good place. He's apologized to his teammates already last year. All of that feels like it's behind him, and he's only got one more game left on that suspension. So Chris Davis is a huge part of the team. He's a huge piece, and he seems to be pretty relaxed compared to where he was when he was with the team last year during the playoffs.
Do you think a season sort of somewhere in between 13 and 14 is a pretty reasonable, I mean, obviously somewhere in between, he's almost certainly not going to do one of those two, but kind of split the difference is probably a pretty reasonable expectation for what Davis can produce in 15?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I would guess. He's not quite as good as he was in 2013, and he's not as bad as he was last season. So when you look at what he was able to do last year, that batting average stands out to me. He's not a 196 hitter. I know he was very proud of his batting average, what he was able to do in 13, the consistency he was able to show.
Even when the power came and went, he was still able to contribute to them.
And I think he's still going to be a contributor this year as well. But,
again, like you said, it's going to be in the middle ground. He's still a very solid player. He's going to be a
a big part of what the Orioles are doing, but he's not going to go on that historic run every year. I mean, that's just ridiculous to think that he would.
You touched a couple minutes ago on David Lowe, who I think is a really interesting player and potentially a really valuable player for a club that hits home runs but doesn't always get on base. What kind of opportunity is there for him if he's healthy and productive? How much of a chance is there for him with this club coming out of the gates?
Well, there's two different camps, really. On one side, you could say that he could be ideal Tracy because they have Orlando De Anza, they have Travis Snyder. They've got guys who can play out there in the outfield. I mentioned Cabrera. They're going to use him some. They're going to use Dylan Young's son. Steve Pierce is a guy who can play in the outfield and is going to get regular at bat. So where does David Lowe fit in? Maybe his best bet is fitting in at another organization. He certainly could do that. Now, what seems to think, or at least probably seems to state that he's a piece of what they're doing. And in that regard, he could help them defensively. I know he struggled offensively, but they felt like the concussion he had last spring really carried over. So he could end up being a guy who plays left field, one of their only true backup center fielders if something happens with Adam Jones. He could platoon a little bit in left field there, but there's not a clear-cut role for him, which is why it's interesting. Cabrera's going to play outfield. If Cabrera ends up being a utility guy and they determine that Ryan Flaherty has a spot on this team, does David Lowe have a chance to get any kind of playing time? Does he serve any kind of role at that time? I don't know. Again, there's a lot of things they can do because they have to make a roster move after that first game for Chris Davis. There's a lot of interesting different ways they can move around. They can have an extra bat for a game. They can have an extra pitcher for a game and kind of figure it out and go from there. But right now, his role is really, really unclear.
And then another guy you mentioned a couple minutes ago is Steve Pierce, who, again, is kind of an interesting position, a guy who was really a big part of this club, especially second half last year. And you wrote this week that he's going to kind of bounce around some. It looks like he would be the primary DH, but how many different ways might they use Pierce both this spring and this season?
Well, he could use it for his base, and he very well could be the opening day guy there. Like I said, with David being suspended, he's going to be used at DH, as you mentioned, the corner outfield spot. Also, doctors throw out the idea of wanting him to get some reps at their base, and it's something that I asked Buck about again yesterday, and he said that early on in spring, not as much. We're going to move Pierce around, but it's not out of the question that he gets some time at third base this spring just to present another option. I think he deserves consistent at-bats, and if they have to move him around for the Orioles to be competitive and for Steve Pierce to get there, that's what they're going to do. He really graduated last year from being just that platoon guy to being a big part of the Orioles. And it's funny to watch him this spring. You would still think that he's trying to make the team. He's just that kind of guy. His mindset hasn't changed at all. He's used to just fighting for his life every spring, which is good to see. But he's really developed into a quiet leader for this team.
And then, of course, the big question around this team remains Manny Machado. He's been there for a while. I'm sure you haven't actually seen him play baseball. We've seen him bouncing around, I assume. Anything to note as to kind of how he looks like he's moving right now this early in camp?
Nothing in particular. He looks normal is probably the best thing I can say. If you didn't know he was coming off of a knee surgery, you wouldn't know. He's running fine. They were doing, drills today, field relay drills. He messed up one of the relays. The guys were getting on him, just kind of like old times again, it seems like. He just looks happy to be back on the field. I mean, he hasn't played a full season since, 2 years ago. That's a long time for a kid that's only 22 years old. Had a lot of success when he came up. He's dealt with back-to-back season-ending knee surgery. So I think he kind of realizes how special this is. And Davis mentioned this earlier to us this morning, that some of these guys don't realize how much fun it is to do what they're doing, and they kind of take it for granted until it's taken away from them. And Manny Machado had baseball taken away from him for a long time, and I think he's just grateful to be out there and back on the field. And he's not going to have any restrictions on him, so there's no reason not to think that he's going to be in that opening day lineup.
And his fellow rehabbing star, Matt Wieters, how's he coming along?
Probably a little slower than Manny. Now, the date for him is March 17th. That's 9 months after his surgery will he be cleared to throw full throttle down to the bases. And because of that and how late it is, you're talking about halfway through March, they're going to find ways for him to catch, to keep his life fresh. Now, whether that's an inter-squad game, whether that's a B league game, a minor league game, something that will require Matt Leiters to still catch and maybe not throw all the way down to second base. Just either let the run game happen, have some kind of agreement Buck has talked about with the other team, or they say, hey, let's play this as a B game, we're not going to run. But they want Matt Leiters' last step to be throwing. They want his legs to be fresh. They want the first game he catches in spring training to be 5 or 6 or even 7 innings. It's too late by March 17th to start catching the guy only 3 innings. A lot of it's going to go based off the feel, how Leiters is doing, how his body is responding. But so far, so good. They feel like there's still a chance. He'll be ready right around opening day.
All right. Well, Brittany Giroli, thanks for taking some time to chat with us here on MLB.com Extras. Talking New York Yankees with MLB.com's Yankees beat reporter Brian Hoke. Brian, you had an interesting piece this week that hit on a theory I've personally had for a while that I don't know there's any real data about, but essentially that CC Sabathia said he feels better when he's got a little more weight, that he thinks he's going to pitch better, he thinks that will be beneficial, not to get out of hand, but that slimming down didn't benefit him. And I've read before and I've had this theory that big pitchers should stay big because they're successful there. What do the Yankees think about this whole question?
Well, if this is something that's going to allow CC to be on the mound and be serviceable for them and have his 25 to 30 starts, then they're all for it. I mean, you look back and when CC was Cy Young Award winner, he was not a slender guy. This is not like he's put on weight overnight. He has always been a big pitcher. He's pitched big before. They won a World Series with him tipping the scales over 300 pounds in 2009. So he felt that by losing the weight, it was as a response to a cousin who died of heart disease, so he obviously had a good reason to do it. But what he found when he came back was his mechanics seemed a little bit off, and he never was really able to regain the form that he was trying to do. It may be partially responsible to the fact that, look, he's just an older pitcher. He's got a lot of miles on his tires at this point, and the body is normally breaking down as he goes into the second phase of his career here. But if there is something to the fact that he can be more on balance and feel like the way CC Sabathia is supposed to be, then the Yankees should be all for it.
Was this something that kind of came out of nowhere as far as you knew, or were there some issues, was there any inkling that maybe something was amiss beyond everything else we've talked about with Sabathia last year?
I think that you're looking at a situation here where he has a degenerative knee condition that's not going to go away, and it's something they're going to have to stay on top of. And in a way, I think that probably affected the way that he was able to train over the offseason. He did say he put on 10 pounds. So I don't think it's like he went home and said, I'm going to put on the weight. I think really what happened is as a result of the knee surgery and not being able to run for a while and work out the way he wanted to, he put on the weight. And now when you're clocking in here at spring training at 305, I think you look at the best-case scenario and you say, he's done it before at that weight. There's no reason why he couldn't, in theory, be effective at that weight again.
Right. The other probably biggest news in the division seemed like it was going to involve the Yankees and didn't. That was Yoan Moncada signing with the Red Sox, or at least agreeing to a deal with the Red Sox. It seemed for a while like the Yankees were very heavy on Moncada and seemed like the favorites. What do you think happened there that didn't ultimately come together?
Yeah, I that was surprising to me. I think we forecasted it somewhere between 75 and 80% that Moncada was going to go to the Yankees, and they were in on him from the very beginning. You don't have a guy come to your complex and work out 3 times if you're not serious about signing him. And at the end of the day, what it came to was the Yankees did make what they felt was a competitive offer for Moncada. They offered him $25 million, which, of course, as we've talked about before, with the penalties, would be a $50 million investment on a 19-year-old prospect who could be the next Robinson Cano or could be something short of that. You don't know. But I think what the Yankees showed there was they like the player. There's no disagreement on the talent. Brian Cashman said that. They think he will be a future major league player. They were outbid, apparently, by the Red Sox and also the Dodgers. So that makes you kind of look at the situation here and say they were willing to go hard on Moncada, but not all in to an extent. And obviously, the Red Sox went higher. It's going to be $63 million total investment for them compared to the Yankees, who offered $50 million and reportedly were willing to go a little bit higher there, but they were not going to top the Red Sox offer.
Were the Yankees surprised at where that ended up going? Because again, you know, it just seemed like they were the club to beat, and it seemed like the Yankees don't often get outbid. Were they surprised where that market went, or did they sort of know all along that there was a point where they might be out of it?
I think there was internal debate within the Yankees. I mean, you're right in that the Yankees do not get outbid for players that they absolutely must have. I can point to the Masahiro Tanaka as a perfect example of a guy, 25 years old. They said, this guy is a stud. They have to have him, and they got him, and they blew everybody else out of the water to get him. I think with Mankata, there was a little question. There were some questions about, look, it's 19. You haven't seen a whole lot of track record. Cuban players are a mystery a little bit. So I think there was some hesitancy there. They were willing to go to a certain point, but I think that when it came to the push or shove and knowing what Boston put out there, they just weren't willing to go that hard for him.
Elsewhere in camp, we're already starting to look at the closer, already starting to ask that question. And you had a piece recently that perhaps co-closers is something that might be in the mix. I know we've discussed this a lot, and I know nobody's actually thrown a pitch in a game yet, but has that situation evolved any over the last couple of weeks since the pitchers came to camp?
Really, no. There hasn't been too much movement. I mean, there's only so much you can tell from a couple of sessions on bullpen mounds, but what I can tell you is that Betances and Miller both look very good. They look strong. They're popping the glove nicely. It's very early in camp. You really need to get into game form here, but I think this is going to be the kind of thing that goes down until there's a week or so left in camp. As we've said before, Joe Girardi said there's no hurry to announce a closer. He likes the idea that maybe you could do co-closers and do it depending on matchups. If, say, there's two lefties or three lefties coming up in the ninth, maybe you change your bullpen a little bit around. But what the Yankees see with Betances and Miller is they have two guys who can do it. They have no doubt about that translating to the ninth inning, even though they haven't really done it yet to this point. And the fact that they can both get lefties and righties out is a plus in the Yankees' eyes. So I feel like I've said it 100 times, but either way, I mean, flip a coin. I think they would be fine picking one way or the other. I still think that Betances will probably be the closer and Miller would be the setup man, but that's always subject to change. And even if they break camp a certain way, it doesn't mean that the season's going to end that way.
I don't mean to have gotten your hopes up. We got 7 minutes into this without mentioning A-Rod, but we're going to mention A-Rod. He arrived in camp, and somewhat predictably, there was some whispered report today that somehow the organization wasn't pleased with his early arrival. It seems to me we're in this situation where no matter what he does, there's going to be some sort of whisper. And this may be a dumb or obvious question, but is this just, when this stuff comes out, is this people just looking for any story they can because A-Rod gets clicks and sells papers, or is there really some sort of fundamental fractured relationship between the player and the club?
Well, he does get clicks and he does sell newspapers, I can tell you that. And I think that there's no doubt that I think people remember what happened over the last year plus, and they're, I mean, that's just not going to go away. You can't delete it overnight. But, you know, I'll go back to that statement that the Yankees put out with Alex, the joint statement from a few weeks ago when they met at Yankee Stadium, and, you know, they agreed about what had happened. Alex apologized for it. He later put out that handwritten letter. But at this point, there is nothing else to do but get him on the field and go on to playing baseball. So that's what he's doing. He's down here in Tampa. He hit again today. He's been out there at the complex. He's been signing autographs. He's been talking a little bit. He's been saying the right things, kind of sticking to the script about having made mistakes and having paid his price and looking forward to getting back in uniform. And what he keeps saying is, I'm here to make this team. He's not taking anything for granted, and he shouldn't, because Joe Girardi's made it very clear that whatever playing time goes to him, be it as a DH, third base, first base, he's going to have to earn it. So the Yankees have protected themselves in the case that A-Rod shows up and cannot do it anymore. And look, there's a chance of that. He's 39 going on 40 on a couple of bad hits, and he's played 44 games in the last 2 years. But, you know, if you look back at what he did in the second half of 2013, that performance, that OPS there, that would have been one of the best, if not the best, performance on the Yankees last year. So clearly, if he can hit and he can come in and contribute, I don't think it's going to be that much of a problem in the clubhouse. I think there's going to be a lot of noise. The circus is going to be in town. People are going to be talking about it. But, you know, between the white lines is where A-Rod is the most comfortable. And I think that that's where he really wants to be. And if he can help the Yankees win games, look, they're paying him anyway. You might as well have him in the lineup.
I know full well that everybody looks good on February 23rd, 24th, but is there anything you can glean at all, not about his baseball shape, because there's no way we're going to know that, but about his sort of physical shape, movement, health, any of that stuff, is there anything you can glean from what you've seen from whatever it may be a few hours of him out on the field so far?
To me, with the naked eye, he looks a lot like the guy who was here at the end of 2013. He doesn't look a whole lot different than that. You know, some people have said he looks a little pudgier in the face area. I'm not sure I agree with that. He looks like the same Alex to me. He looks like he's in shape. He was running in the outfield. He was moving about as well as he did a year and a half ago. I'm sure that time is taking its toll, and he's probably not going to go back to MVP level A-Rod. I think we can all agree on that. But if he can come back and be what he was at the end of 2013 or even close to that, he can help the Yankees win games. I mean, this is a team that struggled to score runs last year, that finished second but won 84 games in the division. They were hurting for offense all summer long. So even if he's on the bench and he's a threat in the late innings, he's a guy that Joe Girardi could go to, another option there on the lineup card, he could definitely contribute to the team. And that's something that Carlos Beltran said. You know, Beltran has never played with A-Rod, but he said if he shows up and he's in shape, knowing what he does, he'll make a difference here.
All right, well, Brian Hoke, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Toronto Blue Jays with MLB.com's Blue Jays beat reporter, Gregor Chisholm. Gregor, there's been a number of little pieces of news around Jays camp already, and to me one of the more intriguing ones is the final acknowledgement from Deonner Navarro that he would like a trade. It's not exactly earth-shattering because we've known for a while that they kind of had some pieces that didn't necessarily fit and it would benefit them. But how does this change the situation? Does it add any urgency? Does it change the dynamic at all, or is it just Navarro finally admitting that, hey, I'd like to play every day?
I think it really is just the public acknowledgement that Navarro, you know, basically said what we knew all along, and that he, you know, thinks of himself as an everyday catcher. The one piece of news that came out was that he said as soon as the Blue Jays signed Russell Martin to that 5-year contract, right away, before even the ink was dry, he asked Alex Anthopoulos for a trade. But I mean, Alex Anthopoulos is normally very tight-lipped about all these types of situations, but really from day one, he was very clear that the Jays were going to do what they could to try and find a deal for Navarro. If there was a starting job for him out there and the Blue Jays could get something in return, that they were going to be more than willing to do that. That's still the stance the team has right now, but I think the Jays are still looking to get some kind of asset in return. They're not looking to just get rid of him because he's one of the biggest trade chips that they have right now. And there's not going to be a lot of value until there's probably an injury somewhere. Maybe it'll happen in spring training. Maybe it'll happen in April. But they really kind of need to wait for the possibility of someone else on another team going down so that they can get a suitable trade offer, because as things stand right now, that just hasn't happened. Anthopoulos has been pretty open about this entire situation. They've never really been close to dealing Navarro. I think some teams kicked the tires on him throughout the winter, but there really wasn't a lot of rumors. And the reason why there weren't a lot of rumors surrounding Navarro is just because the Jays just never got close, still haven't gotten close to finding a fit in a trade.
Is there any kind of concern about how he will approach things as he waits for this to go down?
I don't think so. I mean, Navarro's probably one of the most liked teammates in that clubhouse. He gets along with everybody really well. It's an interesting situation because, you know, Russell Martin is the same guy who took his job back in the Dodgers days quite a long time ago. So he's actually been through this with Martin before. They have a decent working relationship. It's not an ideal situation for anybody. Obviously, I think Navarro, especially coming off the year he had last year, exceeded expectations from his standards, at least, and had a pretty solid year. And it was a guy who was really waiting around. He spent 4 years as a backup, kind of bounced around the league and was really waiting for that opportunity. Didn't get it until last year, and when he came through the way he did, I think the fact that the Blue Jays went out and got another catcher really caught him by surprise. I think he's a little bit offended by it. I think there's a little, he feels a little bit of sense of betrayal, but you know, he's reported on camp on time. You know, he's still going through all the motions. He's not the kind of guy who's just, you know, he came out with some pretty strong comments this week. He's not really the kind of guy who's just going to go ahead and, you know, sulk and not put his work in. You know, I think as of right now, the Blue Jays are just going to have to go forward with him in the plans as a backup catcher. There's some at-bats at DH as well. You know, that's not the situation Navarro wants, but that's the situation the Blue Jays have him in. But, I mean, this really could change, you know, any time. It can change in 24 hours. If somebody gets hurt and another team decides that they have a need, there will probably be a move. So Navarro could be here a week. He could be here 3 months. No one really knows. But he remains very available.
And that ties into my next question, which is another thing you reported this week, which is that Edwin Encarnacion, who, to use the old joke, whose best position is batter's box, is apparently going to be playing in the field some. Is that related to Navarro's situation? And whether it is or is not, what is the thought process there?
I think so. You know, Anthopoulos spent a lot of time this offseason talking about how the Blue Jays really want to get him most of his at-bats at DH. There is some concern with some back pain that he's experienced over the last couple of years. He's worn down a little bit from playing the field every day. I think he prefers the DH spot, but he's also more than willing to play the field. I mean, that's essentially what he's been doing most of the time over the last couple of years now. So I don't think anything really changes too much, but you know, the stance of the Jays coming out and saying that they want him to be the first baseman, what that does is it does open up at-bats for Navarro. So if Navarro gets dealt, I could see the Blue Jays changing their mind on that, because you know, the other people that they have in the mix right now for DH would be, in addition to Navarro, would be guys like Justin Smoke and Danny Valencia. Justin Smoke is probably a better defender at first base than Encarnacion is. So when both those guys are in the lineup at the same time, it makes sense to put Smoke at first and Encarnacion at DH. But if Navarro is on this team and they're looking to find ways to get him at bats, that would have to come at the DH spot because he can't play first base. I think that's going to be in a bit of a state of flux over the next few weeks, depending on what the team does. But they're certainly positioning this, I think, maybe even as a way to kind of boost Navarro's value a little bit from around the league, to show that they're not going to be forced into making a deal because they can find him at bats for the team.
It's far, far too early. It'll be too early 2 weeks into games. But even so, it's fantasy draft season, and people want to know where they get their saves. Obviously, the competition itself hasn't changed any, but has anything anybody said or any kind of structure of camp or anything tipped any kind of hand about how this ninth inning situation is going to go with the Jays?
Well, the one development this week that I found somewhat interesting was the fact that Brett Cease on day one came out and gave a very honest answer. He said, absolutely, I want the job. He doesn't think that he has anything to prove to this team. He said he can't go out to tank spring training by any means, but he doesn't think he has anything to prove either, because he thinks the Blue Jays know what he can do. He's shown it over the last couple of years. He does have a handful of saves over the last couple of years as well, and when he was put in those situations when Casey Jansen needed a day off, he handled it just fine. But I think more than anything else, the decision for the closer job isn't really going to be based on performance per se. I think it's going to be more on the configuration of the bullpen and what the Blue Jays decide to do down there. I mean, I think they really need to get a close look at how Steve Delabar looks once games start, and see whether or not he can become a setup option from the right side. Because if he's not the guy that he was 2 years ago, if he looks more like the guy he was last year, you know, they're really lacking a lot of depth on the right side. And I think that would really kind of force the hand of using a guy like Aaron Sanchez, as opposed to limiting him to just the ninth inning, almost, you know, a Dylan Betances role from the Yankees last year, where you could bring him in the seventh or eighth inning, maybe throw even a couple innings at a time, something that he did in the second half with the Blue Jays last year. So it's going to be an interesting mix, because at the same time, you also have the Blue Jays coming out and saying, sticking to what their plan was with Sanchez in the first place, which is he's going to spend the initial stages of spring training getting stretched out, because they do want to build his arm up a little bit. Even if he does end up in the bullpen, they think there's going to be some benefit there. The one thing we do know is that a decision on this will probably come sooner rather than later. It looks like probably at the very latest, the Jays want to make a decision on Sanchez's future by the middle of March, because if he is going to go into the bullpen, they're going to take him out of that starting a little bit more of a reliever routine in those final few weeks of camp to get ready for the season. But still, anyone's guess at this point. I would say Brett Cecil has a slight edge, but it still could go either way at this point.
And you just touched on a whole lot of different considerations and factors, but would it be putting it too strongly to say that the biggest decision in all of this is the decision on how they use Sanchez, because that not only tips some of the balances this year, but obviously has some impact over where this guy's future goes over the next several years?
Yeah, absolutely, because, I mean, if he spends this year as a reliever, it's going to have an impact on his starting here next year when there be some serious innings limit. You know, that's not necessarily an easy transition. I mean, it's something that's kind of the game's gone away from over the last decade. So, I mean, it's something that used to happen a lot, and obviously Adam Wainwright is the perfect example that the Blue Jays like to use of guys who have made that transition where you kind of break into the bullpen and then make that move. That's someone Anthopoulos likes to point to a lot. But, yeah, Sanchez is without a doubt the biggest wild card in all of this. And, you know, I think everybody within the organization believes that his long-term value, there's no question about it, that he's better used in the rotation. You know, he still does have an outside shot at that fifth spot, but it's just the need in the bullpen right now. I think ultimately that's going to force the Jays to move him into the bullpen. But the upside is, there's just so much upside there with him that if he comes, you know, in those initial starts and really blows the doors off everybody and really outperforms a guy like, you know, fellow top prospect Daniel Norris, I mean, maybe it's something the Blue Jays have to look at. But at this point, the way the bullpen is shaped up, I just can't see the Blue Jays being able to do that, because if you don't have Sanchez down there in the bullpen, there's just so many question marks. I mean, really, your only two proven guys down there would be Aaron Loop and Brett Cecil, and going into the season, that's a bit of a scary proposition. If you move Sanchez in there, gives you another reliable piece that really gives you, you know, some solid options from the seventh inning on. And ultimately, I think that's the way the Jays are going to go. But you know, things could change. It's going to be interesting, and that's definitely just the domino effect that has to take place in camp.
All right. Well, Gregor Chisholm, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Tampa Bay Rays with MLB.com's Rays beat reporter Bill Chastain. Bill, it's earlier in Rays camp than it is in a lot of camps, and one of the big changes so far is the change of the manager. What have you seen so far? Not that you can glean a lot, I understand that, but we're all about making a lot out of small sample sizes when it's February and it's baseball. What have you seen so far from Kevin Cash as far as style, presence, that kind of thing?
Well, he seems very comfortable in his new role. He's obviously not quite the showman that Joe Maddon is or was with the Rays, and he seems fine with that. In fact, it's funny, talking to Desmond Jennings, who reported today that I kidded Desmond, who doesn't like to talk a lot. He said he was speaking with Cash, and I said, so you guys probably were hit it off pretty well because you don't like to talk too much. And he said, yep. So, but right now, you know, the confidence in the guy seems really good. You know, some of these guys remember him from when they played against him. Some of them just seem to, you know, appreciate having a, you know, kind of a refresher, having a new guy in, a new voice. And right now the optimism is pretty high here.
We've talked about this some, but even, you know, even somebody like Tony La Russa said this, and I think if football coaches will say, you'll hear it nearly everywhere. At some point, a voice starts to get stale, even a great voice, even one of the best in the business. At some point, there's benefit to having a new voice and a new style. Without taking anything away from Joe Maddon, who I think may very well be the best manager in the game right now, do you think that there is potentially some inherent value just in having a voice, somebody different leading the show?
I totally believe that. And you know, one part of that equation, too, is players, a lot of players seem to feel like they've got a clean slate. And that not only extends to Maddon, but, you know, having a new GM as well, and, you know, Matt Silverman taking over for Friedman. So I think everyone, you know, feels, some people who might have felt like they weren't, you know, in the best standing with Joe, you know, probably feel like they've got a new, you know, new thing. And And again, like you said, La Russa said, and you and I talked about it some during the offseason, the message gets stale after a while, and a lot of the fun things he was doing with the team, you know, to keep it fresh were, you know, the rose was off that bloom. So it is kind of funny, though. One thing I would say is that a lot of times you'll see, in my observations, is when a manager like Madden is followed, you know, Madden, who's kind of like a player's manager, you know, normally you see kind of like the guy come in with the hard edge, and Cash certainly is not that guy.
What do you see about how, in that regard, how he'll sort of relate to the players, carry himself, and that kind of thing?
Well, right now he's big on trying to get to know all of them and communicate, and he was talking today about how much he appreciated when a manager would communicate with him, you know, based on his career. You know, he said he was always on the verge of getting sent down. So he referenced Terry Francona and how much he respected what he would do, because he didn't treat people differently based on their hierarchy in the game. Everybody was treated the same. And he said, you know, that really made a difference for him, because, you know, guys who are lower on the totem pole, again, who are, you know, worried about job security, there's a lot of factors that go into, you know, that can make their life miserable. And, you know, the thing you don't see is the manager, you know, not treating you like you're a part of the team.
You've had a couple of pieces already this week looking at the bullpen and what might go down in the ninth inning, with Jake McGee out for a while, with Grant Balfour having been signed to do that job last year. Obviously, nobody's really taken these steps in the competition, but how does that kind of shake down as far as how the ninth is going to look at the beginning of the year?
Well, I think they probably will try and see if Balfour can reclaim the thing. And based on what he did in September, 12 of 13 outings were scoreless. He looked like a different guy in September than, you know, the same guy who lost his job, primarily because of his control. But, you know, while they're waiting for Jake McGee to come back, they've also got Kevin Gibson, and that looks like a great deal for both the Angels and the Rays at this point, because obviously Matt Joyce could help the Angels out while Josh Hamilton's gone, and Gibson's coming off a really nice year with the Angels, and he's the kind of guy who can pitch at the end of the game. You also got the newcomer Ernesto Ferreri, Brad Boxberger, Jeff Beliveau. There's a lot of different names in there that have pitched in high leverage situations, so I think they'll be comfortable with that. And I do think that, you know, it could be, you know, while nobody probably wants to hear this, but, you know, rarely do you see a guy come back from any kind of surgery and he's right, you know, back on top form. So I'd be surprised we don't see a little bit of rust on McGee when he does come back, even if they are optimistic that he might be, you know, back pretty soon this season.
What does his time frame look like?
You know, they haven't given us an official thing yet, but he seems to think it's going to be May. And he based that on, you know, it was a similar operation to what happened to Jeremy Hellickson last year, which basically was defined as a elbow cleanup. And Hellickson came back, I believe it was June, but he had it a month later. And in addition to that, he was a starting pitcher. So he had to not only be healthy, but he had to build himself up like spring training as far as, like, you know, the, you know, going deep into the game. Having said that, like I said earlier, you know, Helly never did really feel totally comfortable when he came back last year. You know, there's, you know, so much goes into muscle memory and everything as far as being able to throw the strikes within the strike zone where you want to. And, you know, I think that's the hard part coming back. So how quickly he does that will be a, you know, a big thing.
You mentioned the sort of up and, or not up and down, down and up year that Balfour had last year, and the location, the control being an issue. What is there any read as to what went wrong and what he did to get it right?
Well, you know, one thing he talked to me about late last season, he said that that they've, like a sports psychologist, Ken Revisa, and he said he actually helped him some, you know, on how he would frame his mind up on some of these things. But I guess, you know, that's one of those things, a precarious thing, being able to throw strikes. And sometimes when you're not able to throw them, you know, it works on your mind. And I know he had a couple of things early in the season last year where he gave up a game-winning grand slam against the White Sox, and I think it came right after, you know, he thought he had strike three in that inning. And, you know, you kind of start getting this snowball feeling like, you know, baseball gods are against you. And I think he had a little bit of that last year. And there's no telling how much it's been weighing on his mind. You know, his father is ill in Australia, and that's something that, you know, is always on mind, I'm sure, for him.
Well, Bill Chastain, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Boston Red Sox with MLB.com's Red Sox beat reporter Ian Brown. In the next quiet, easy-to-cover Red Sox camp will be the first, and they continued that glorious tradition with making some very big news this week, bringing in the very exciting Cuban infield prospect, Yoán Moncada. There's a lot of questions about this, but I think the first one that comes to mind is how exactly does he fit in? This guy is an infielder, and this club seems pretty set, not just for a year or two, but for a long time at second base, shortstop, and third base.
Yeah, you know, the exciting thing about Moncada, Matthew, is he's one of those athletic types, you know, in the mode of a Mookie Betts or someone like that, so he can put really anywhere on the diamond. So they're not all that concerned with what position he's going to play. They'll find a spot for him, and really, you look at a situation where in a couple of years, you know, David Ortiz isn't going to be on this team forever. You know, as hard as that is to believe. So, you know, you could throw a guy like Pablo Sandoval in the DH spot, and that would open up, you know, a spot in the infield for Moncada, whether it's third base. I mean, it seems like a lot of people think that his best position long range might be third base or outfield. You know, I don't think he's kind of a big guy, so I'm not sure, you know, how that's going to make him project as a middle infielder, shortstop, second base type. Sounds like he might be kind of big and strong for that. But they're just thrilled to get this guy because, you know, Red Sox owner John Henry really put it best today. He said, you know, this is our 14th year here with the Red Sox, and we've never had the number one pick in the draft. So are we willing to pay a little extra money to get the number one pick in the draft, which they think Moncada is the equivalent of? You know, absolutely. So that's why they went out and got this player, because they think that he's the best amateur player they think who's going to be available for quite some time here.
I know that we really don't know until we see more. I mean, there's not a lot of film of this guy as a player. We really don't know much about him. But from your conversations with Red Sox people, what kind of player does Moncada project as? I've heard a lot of different names and a lot of different things. What's the sort of profile of player that they expect him to become once he is developed?
Yeah, you know, Robinson Cano was one name I heard mentioned, and really the guy's got a combination here of power and speed and explosiveness. You know, he's just one of those super athletic types who can probably do a little bit of everything, and they're just really excited about his body type. And I spoke to Louis Tian yesterday, and he was really excited just about the kid's demeanor. You know, he really seems to want to get better, and he wants to really be great. So there's really a lot of things that they like about him. And they spent a lot of time scouting Cuba. You know, Ben Cherington talked about this today, how the Red Sox have really reprioritized Cuba a couple years ago. And they assigned two scouts over there who really worked a lot in Cuba to just kind of really know that market. And so they feel good about the studying they've done on Moncada.
You lead into my next question, which is about the Red Sox in Cuba, and it's really interesting to me. You know, there's this theory that as it gets harder for big revenue clubs to sort of assert that advantage, you've got the luxury tax on major league payroll, you've got the slotting system in the draft. That one of the places where a club with a huge revenue can still take advantage of that is international. Is that part of what's going on here with the Red Sox, that they have identified a place where they can take advantage of their financial strength, or is it really just a matter of this is a talent source and they're going to tap into it?
Yeah, no, I think they hit the nail on the head. The Red Sox are really trying to play find places where they can take advantage of the fact that, hey, we have more money than a lot of other teams. We're bringing in a lot more revenue than a lot of teams out there. And, hey, the Red Sox have learned that traditional free agency is no longer really the way to go, though they did make a couple big additions in Hanley Ramirez and Pablo Sandoval to their offense. You know, they're not crazy about signing these 30-year-olds anymore, because more and more of these guys, as they get to their mid-30s, they're not living up to those contracts. So they say, hey, let's put some more money into the international side of things, find the next big thing, find players that are equivalent to what we could get high in the draft. And if we have to spend a little extra money on it, let's do it. We have the money. So it's just kind of reallocating resources in a way that they think that, you know, they can exploit some inefficiencies, and they better do that before this draft becomes international, which seems like that could be a matter of time.
Yeah, and you hit on something I kind of misspoke. With Major League free agency, it's really a matter of guys don't hit free agency anymore. I mean, it's kind of a change in how baseball is done, is that the best players don't hit free agency, and the Red Sox kind of took advantage of that to some extent, or I don't know how exactly you put that, but with a guy like Porcello, who is approaching free agency, that guy's probably not going to hit the market. There's a decent chance the Red Sox are going to find a way to keep him around for a long time. Which leads into the next thing, believe it or not. There is a plan here. This is a rotation that we've talked about a lot, has been talked about a lot, as a deep but not necessarily top-heavy rotation. As these guys show up to camp, is there anything that's caught your eye about any of these starting pitchers that is noteworthy or interesting from these first few early throws?
You know, I think it's good that Clay Buchholz comes in fully healthy, didn't have a single issue late last season health-wise, and got a bunch of bullpens. And where last year, the first bullpen he threw all winter was when he got to spring training, because he really had to take it easy last offseason, coming off the injury he had at the end of that year. So he looks pretty confident. You know, Rick Porcello, kind of, it's been fun watching him on the bullpen. This guy's got some pretty good stuff, and I think he's learned a lot from observing the Justin Verlanders and Max Scherzers of the world, and he looks to me like a guy who might be sort of ready to come into his own. He did have his best year last year. You know, Justin Masterson's a guy a lot of people just kind of forget from their memory, because he had such a horrible year last year, but, you know, Masterson thinks that was just about all related to the rotation injury he had, that was the oblique thing that was really affecting everything in his delivery. So, you know, he's pretty confident he can bounce back. So, yeah, I think they feel pretty good about the depth of pitching. You know, yeah, they don't have that ace, and it just continues to be talked about every day how they don't have that ace. But I think the Red Sox feel good about, you know, the numbers they have in the rotation. I think they feel reasonably good about the guy they're going to throw out there each day in that five-man rotation.
Is there any change in kind of how that bullpen looks? Again, we're sort of grasping at straws here. They've been in camp for a week, but is, yeah, anybody sort of, have you heard names to watch out for in the bullpen as they sort of try and put that mix together?
Yeah, I think that they're pretty excited, Matthew, about Alexi Egondo. Another guy like Masterson kind of fell off the map after one really, really bad year with injuries mixed in. He looks, he looks healthy right now. He's throwing the ball hard, so this could be a real, real weapon for them in the sixth, seventh inning to help. You know, they have Tozawa and Koji still in the back end, but they really think that a healthy Egondo could give them a good look in that bullpen.
The expectations with the Red Sox are pretty much always high. They spend a lot of money. They win a lot. But for a team that finished in fifth place last year, there seems to be a lot of hype externally about how good this club can be. Do you hear people around the organization talking about this as a team that is one of the best or maybe the best in the American League?
Certainly the East. I mean, this American League East is the most underwhelming it's been on paper since I've been covering the Red Sox. And this is year 14 for me. That just doesn't seem to be any dominant team in this division. And the Red Sox, you know, have a nice mix of talent that's both in their prime and some young guys who could be ready to emerge. So, yeah, I mean, John Henry is saying today that he thinks that this team is much better positioned this year than they were in 2013 when they went on to win the World Series. That team just kind of came together and everything went right. This team might have more talent on paper. The one difference is that team had Lester and Lackey, a couple of real proven guys at the top of the rotation. So we'll see if that ends up making the big difference. But, yeah, the Red Sox, you know, there's a really good vibe in this camp, and everyone seems pretty confident that they can have a rebound season. Yeah, much more confidence at this time now than there was 2 years ago when they were, again, coming off the last place finish that year as well.
All right, well, Ian Brown, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras, and thanks, everybody, for listening.